This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Scott Horton about the Department of Justice's anti-whistleblower meltdown.
Why, after Obama promised otherwise, are more whistleblowers being prosecuted than in all other administrations combined?
We'll take a look at how the BDS movement is taking root in our own backyard.
As support for BDS grows locally, domestically, and internationally, the forces of darkness that support Israel and the settlements and oppose it are also fighting back.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Heidi, when I opened the New York Times blog last week, I was pleased to see an article called Courthouse Confidential. And there was our own Heidi Boghossian sitting in front of a window with all kinds of law books in front of her and talking about a new initiative of the National Lawyers Guild and Heidi Boghossian, which is to get lawyers for the people who the U.S. is going after, the government is going after, for Anonymous and Lulzsec, which has to do with, quote, hackers or something like that. But what's this about, Heidi?
Well,
great picture, though, Heidi. And I advise everybody to go to the New York Times and look for Heidi's picture if you want to see what the hostess of the mostest looks like.
Oh, gosh. Anyway, this
Heidi, that was really made up.
Shucks.
You don't really think that.
No. Okay, look. When WikiLeaks happened, a lot of activists went online. When PayPal and other banks denied access to money to WikiLeaks, people protested the way, you know, over the centuries, people are protesting things in the streets. Now we have the internet and we have sort of cyber activism. And what they did was they downloaded software that lets you go to a corporate website and sort of hit it multiple times so that what it does is it slows it down. And I think that if people go and read some of the comments on the blog, you'll see a little debate going on about whether this constitutes a criminal activity. And the Guild thinks it doesn't.
In this case, it was PayPal. And I think it was PayPal because they had cut off, through MasterCard and Visa, the funding for WikiLeaks.
Exactly.
And that's a big deal because here you have 95% of the market for donations is controlled between MasterCard and Visa. PayPal.
is the
door. And private companies just decide on their own. Let's remember, there's no criminal indictment of WikiLeaks or Julian Assange at this point.
Exactly.
Corporations
made a decision.
And they made a decision to just cut them off from any funding. Very dangerous. So what did you do, Heidi, as a result? There was these protests, which the Guild, to its great credit, and people ought to hear it again, what does the Guild think of these kind of
We are supportive of people's decision to engage in what we call civil disobedience, this being what we see as kind of the new frontier. Since so much of our daily communications, personal business, and not just financial business, but personal information is floating out on the web, and corporations, quite honestly, don't listen to you if you write them a letter or do a little picket somewhere. They're creating laws like the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act to punish people who try to boycott a business.
So what did you set up, Heidi?
We set up a website called anonlg.com.
A-N-O-N-L-G.com.
And it's for activists to go to have basically a repository of Know Your Rights information, including a lot of information from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, CCRs. A book is on there and some Know Your
CCR's
Rights.
CCR's book is a Know Your Rights type
pamphlet. It's When an Agent Knocks.
The Guild has one that you've been involved with?
We do. You have the right to remain silent. And then we have sort of scenarios of what to happen, cautioning, of course, that this is not a replacement for sound legal advice. And so what we've also done is set up a hotline, and there's a number to call or an email on the website, and we are trying to match individuals with pro bono attorneys around the country so that if they've received a subpoena or if they've been arrested in the rash of recent raids that happened a few months ago where the FBI and Department of Justice went after individuals they think are connected to this, and they face some harsh sentences.
No, this is
serious
thing.
Serious stuff.
And this, I think what you guys did on the website and what you've said, is this is really the equivalent of First Amendment type speech. So when I came up to the office today to do this recording with you, there's a huge picket going outside of Verizon by CWA, a union picket because of legitimate labor grievances with Verizon. This is no different except on the internet.
Right.
And you've coined a great term for it. And what do you call what's going on? We had the communist scare.
The Red Scare.
We had the
environmental
green scare. And now what do we have?
The nerd scare.
Oh, my gosh. I hope all the Anon people listening don't get offended at the nerd scare.
We think it's a high compliment.
It is, actually.
Yeah.
In this day and age, the nerds have replaced the running halfback for my football team. Yay, go nerds. Anyway, again, the website is www.anonlg.com. We really want to thank the Guild, Heidi, et cetera. Anything else you want to say about this, Heidi?
We'd like to thank the New York Times for their interest in this story.
Heidi, again, I'm so excited that you and the Guild have this project to represent the people of Anonymous. And as I said, I always love their quote, and I can't give the whole quote by heart, but I can give a little bit of it. It goes, "We are Anonymous. We are Legion. We do not forgive. We do not forget."
Oh,
anyway, there's Anonymous.
That's great.
Michael, a lot of our listeners may not have heard of Joe Hill. I mean, you heard of him in song. We have some idea who he was, some kind of labor leader. But who was Joe Hill quickly? And what's the new revelation about Joe Hill?
Joe Hill is a legendary figure in America like Johnny Appleseed. He was the great industrial workers of the world, the IWW, the Wobblies. He was a great figure in the Wobblies, well known even before he was framed up on a murder charge in Utah and executed by a firing squad in 1915. But Hill was Swedish, came here, one of the many, many immigrant workers, pretty much migrant workers, worked in the farms and mills and factories from the Bronx to the Dakotas down to Southern California, went up to Utah. By this time, he was famous for being the Wobbly musician. Half the songs in the Little Red Songbook are written by Joe Hill.
Can you sing one for us?
Long-haired preachers come out every night, try to teach you what's wrong and what's right.
That's great, Michael.
That is great.
But when asked, how about something to eat,
they'll answer in words that are sweet.
So
yeah, I know.
Sweet.
Okay.
Long-haired preachers come out every night, try to teach you what's wrong and what's right. But when asked for something to eat, they will answer with words that are sweet. You will eat by and by. In that wonderful land up in the sky, chop some wood, it'll do you good. You'll get pie in the sky when you die.
Excellent.
Well, that was great, Michael.
The song goes on. It's Preacher and the Slave, written by Joe Hill in 1911. Michael did, there's various versions of the song. Of course, it was recorded by the Weavers, Pete Seeger, Utah Phillips, etc. A great song.
Anyway, so here's what happened to Joe Hill.
Yeah.
He participated in the Mexican Revolution in Baja California. He was known to the sheriff in San Pedro, the little port city south of L.A. When he got arrested and framed up on this murder charge in Utah, the sheriff in San Pedro sent the sheriff in Salt Lake City a telegram saying, get this guy. And they did. The copper bosses in Utah hated Joe Hill because of his union organizing. The Mormon Church, which ran Utah, still does, hates unions. And they framed him up on a murder charge. And the new book that just came out, Roger Hollander's book, The Man Who Wouldn't Die, has researched this. And he demonstrates that, in fact, the person who did the murder was a common criminal who later joined up with Al Capone.
Wow.
In the meantime, Joe Hill, age 36, was shot. In his last will, he said, whatever you do, don't bury me. I don't want to be found dead in Utah. So he was cremated. His ashes were separated into tiny little bags and sent to the IW chapters all across the country. And Joe Hill's ashes were scattered in every state in the United States. And people still sing his songs, know about him. And now, thanks to Roger Hollander, they'll know for certain that this was what everybody said at the time, including President Wilson, who tried to save his life, that it was a frame-up.
Michael, talking about frame-ups, I saw one of the best movies I've seen really in years. It's called Better This World. The poster about it says, two friends, eight bombs, one FBI informant. It's been showing at several film festivals. It's coming to New York this week. It will be showing at the IFC Center. That's on 6th Avenue. and West 4th Street, ifccenter.com. You can get your times. It's playing tonight, Monday the 15th through Thursday the 18th. I highly recommend it. It's basically about an activist turned FBI informant, Brandon Darby, and how he cultivated relationships with two young activists who were going to the 2008 RNC in the Twin Cities. And I won't tell you what happens, but as some of the reviews say, it's gripping, disturbing, a fascinating study of the methods employed in combating terrorism in the wake of 9/11. Riveting, structured like a top thriller. I cannot praise this movie enough.
What's the name of it again?
Better This World. It got Best Documentary Feature at the San Francisco International Film Festival, several other awards.
You know, it leads me to this whole question of putting informants in groups, which is what happened in that movie, right? Where this guy convinces people supposedly to throw Molotov or construct Molotov cocktails or something. What it leads to is another story that came out this last week. You know, a couple of months ago, maybe more, we covered the infiltration of the mosques in Southern California by an informant who supposedly was there in 2006, 2007, went through the mosques. Hundreds, maybe thousands of people were, in quote, informed on when they were had done nothing. He just made records of them, supposedly turned them over to the FBI, etc. Well, CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, and the ACLU went to court in a lawsuit on behalf of the people in the mosques, behalf of Muslims in Southern California. And then the United States government, under our fine President Obama, took the defense that Obama said they would begin to limit and not take, what they call the get-out-of-court-free defense. And that's what I think Glenn Greenwald called it instead of the get-out-of-jail defense. It's the get out of court free, and it's called state secrecy. And they came into a lawsuit that was on behalf of American citizens in the United States in a religious institution, and they said, we can't tell you anything about the surveillance we were doing there, even though it may have been this massive surveillance of innocent Americans. We can't tell you any of it. It's state secrets. This whole lawsuit must be dismissed. So much for Obama's promises on limiting the get-out-of-court-free state secrets defense. Another case, though, Heidi, about an informant analogous to the movie that you're speaking of. In both your writing and in the new book that Margaret Ratner Kunstler and I wrote, Hell No, Your Right to Dissent in 21st Century America, we talk about how the FBI guidelines now allow informants to be used in any political association, religious association, organization without any criminal predicate.
Yeah.
An informant can just go in.
In fact, the whole fact that there still are so-called guidelines is a sham because they have totally eviscerated
right.
the guidelines.
There are no real guidelines right. anymore.
They're loose lines.
In fact, they
loose
make
lines.
People think that there's somehow guidelines when, in fact, they might as well just say, do whatever you
Anything
want,
goes.
FBI.
Yeah.
You be act the political police you are.
Yeah.
I think that what we're going to see increasingly is the active political police going after people who are protesting the austerity programs that are coming down in this country. And I think that whether they did it intentionally or not over the last decade, what they've done is set up the apparatus for a police state. So when people get out there and protest their loss of Medicare or Medicaid or Social Security or their union rights, the cops have got all these new tools to use. And they're so well documented in your book, Michael, Hell No.
The Obama Justice Department's campaign to stigmatize whistleblowers and force reporters to open up their notebooks under the Espionage Act seems to be failing. Recently, Judge Brinkema, in an opinion released a couple of weeks ago, said prosecutors could not force author and New York Times reporter James Risen to testify about how he learned certain classified information for a book on the CIA. In another case, a former senior NSA official was charged under the Espionage Act and accused of leaking classified information to a newspaper. He recently walked out of court a free man, sentenced to a year's probation and community service, after the judge excoriated the government for its handling of the case. To talk more about the Department of Justice's anti-whistleblower campaign, we're joined by New York attorney Scott Horton, well known for his work in human rights law and the law of armed conflict. Scott is also a contributing editor to Harper's Magazine. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Scott.
Great to be with you.
You've recently covered several cases in which the government has used the Espionage Act of 1917 against whistleblowers. And I think first we'd like to ask, why under the Obama administration are we seeing use of this act?
That's a very, very good question, particularly given the statements that Barack Obama made out on the campaign trail, in which he criticized the Bush administration for its oppression of whistleblowers. He talked about the fact that he, in his earlier career as an attorney, had represented whistleblowers, how they play an important part in our society, how they need and they're entitled to the protection, and how he was going to turn things around when he got into office. But I think we discovered as soon as he was elected, in fact, the pressure on whistleblowers was ratcheted up. Now, when Barack Obama has been confronted about this, in fact, as recently happened in the press conference, he shoots back saying, well, I was talking about whistleblowers in areas other than national security. National security is a different sector, a different kettle of fish altogether, and there it's very important that we safeguard our secrets. So he's basically distinguishing that area of whistleblowing from everything else, and I think he's distancing himself from the commitments he made. Let's come back and talk about the Espionage Act. Historically, there have been dozens of prosecutions of whistleblowers in the national security area in the past, but I'd say the pattern that most frequently unfolds is that there's an internal investigation, an FBI investigation. There is a decision to strip the person of their security classification. They then, without their security qualifications, they usually lose their job. So firing, I'd say, is the most common consequence. And then prosecutions, it's been mishandling government documents and things of that sort. And these prosecutions don't usually lead to long prison terms. So I think what we see is a turn now to the Espionage Act in order to get to justify far more serious terms. So you can have a 10 or 20 year sentence. In fact, under some circumstances, there could even be capital punishment meted out in Espionage Act cases. So that's heightening the pressure on the target. But then there's another aspect of it which is extremely important, and that is the Espionage Act can be used to justify going after reporters, forcing reporters to turn over their notebooks, getting information on the periphery, that is copies of the reporter's telephone statements, phone bills, access to their internet accounts, and ultimately even potentially compelling reporters to give evidence against their sources. So I think that it's those levers that are very, very attractive to the prosecutors, and I think led the Obama Justice Department to turn to them in a programmatic way, because we've got most of the whistleblower prosecutions under the Espionage Act that have been brought are pending right now, and they've been brought by Barack Obama's Justice Department.
Scott, can you highlight some of those? I know you know you've written, and of course, so many others about the Drake case and what happened, but I know that's not the only one, and maybe describe some of the key cases, including Drake.
Well, I'd say the Drake case and the Sterling case are the two most important ones right now. In fact, it's interesting because they both seem to spring from the same investigation. So we know the New York Times in 2005 ran a story by James Risen in which he disclosed for the first time that the NSA had been operating a sweeping surveillance program that, in fact, was referred to within the administration simply as the program or the president's program, in which it had monitored the phone conversations and the internet communications of tens of millions of Americans on a regular basis using special logarithms. And when that was disclosed, remember Dick Cheney gave a couple of speeches. We had a campaign launched by some people close to the president saying that this was basically an act of treason by the New York Times even to disclose this. There were calls in Republican quarters for an investigation into this leak and for a severe prosecution. And it's not clear that the FBI ever ascertained who Risen's source was on that story. But that investigation into the New York Times and Risen and their communications with people in the government did disclose two things. One was one relates to Thomas Drake, who was a senior figure of the NSA, and Drake had disclosed the fact that there was a massive contract boondoggle, overrun, and mismanagement relating to a major, we'll call it software program, that was being prepared for the NSA. It's a little bit more complicated than that. It involved more than $1 billion. He saw corruption, graft, and mismanagement. He brought that to the attention of senior people within the NSA, and then he brought it to the attention of the media. So the NSA took the position that he was disclosing secrets by revealing all of this, and the FBI turned up quite a bit of information about it and brought that prosecution. The second one had to do with Jeffrey Sterling, who had been a CIA agent. He'd been involved in efforts to deal with Iran and Iranian efforts to build a nuclear bomb. He's alleged to have disclosed to the New York Times one particular episode, very embarrassing to the CIA, in which the CIA brought on board a Russian nuclear scientist who was supposed to sabotage the Iranian nuclear program, but in fact it boomeranged. In fact, he passed on vital information that allowed them to build that program. So it was a completely bungled project that involved years and massive sums of money. And its disclosure was intensely embarrassing to the CIA. And the FBI learned about that, and they went after Mr. Sterling. So those are the two major cases that had been brought.
I know that you mentioned that Judge Richard Bennett, who was actually a Republican, a Bush appointee, expressed anger at how the Justice Department was proceeding and, in fact, praised Drake and called the Justice Department management of the case unconscionable. This also seems to tie into the fact that these seem almost retaliatory or politically motivated, given that Barack Obama had highly classified information disclosed to Bob Woodward for the book Obama's Wars.
That's correct. In fact, it's at least a half dozen senior figures in the Obama White House provided extremely sensitive and highly classified information to Bob Woodward for that book. No investigation, no prosecution. And in fact, you can open the New York Times and the Washington Post almost every day and find some sensitive national security secret that's been leaked by a member of the administration to help score a point for the administration. There's never any investigation. We should back this up and say when Jay Mayer wrote a story in The New Yorker about the Drake prosecution, she interviewed Lanny Breuer, who is the assistant attorney general responsible for the criminal division and the man who was making the policy calls here and pushing these things forward. And Breuer told her, you know, we have to proceed to deal with these cases on a scrupulously non-political basis. Politics can never into it. And I have to say, that is the most absurd lie I've heard a senior Justice Department official tell in a long time, because nothing is more clear than that only political considerations drive these cases. So we have this very clear divide between matters where it serves the political interest of the White House or the administration to leak the secret. And I'm not just talking about the Obama administration. Same thing went on under Bush and has gone on under all prior presidents. And those, there's never an investigation of those. There's never a prosecution of those. And then on the other side, disclosure of facts which are embarrassing to political figures in the administration because it shows they behaved corruptly, they behaved irresponsibly, they made a stupid decision. And these embarrassing disclosures are invariably the ones that are targeted for investigation, and the disclosures that prove the most embarrassing are the ones that are most rigorously prosecuted. So there is a 100% political calculus that goes into this, and that in turn delegitimizes the entire process.
We're speaking with Scott Horton, who writes a lot about national security and is a blogger, columnist for Harper's Magazine. Scott, in some of your articles, you've written about who the prosecutor has been in both the Sterling case and the Drake case. It was quite fascinating when I read it, actually revelatory. Can you talk about who that is and what you found out about him?
Well, it's absolutely amazing, in fact, I thought the juxtaposition in the Drake case, which we saw at this one sentencing hearing between the prosecutor and the person who was prosecuted, was amazing. In fact, the judge helped drive that point home. So the person prosecuted, Thomas Drake, was a selfless civil servant who'd spent his entire life serving the government, had served in the Air Force, in the Navy, at the NSA, and had sacrificed throughout his life to advance the interests of government. He was being prosecuted right now because of his concern for taxpayers. He saw fraud and waste in management of a contract. He tried to stop it. He went through every possible proper channel to do it and got nowhere. And then when he allowed it to get into the press, he's prosecuted for doing that. And the judge pointed out, he said, you know, you have no criminal background or problems whatsoever. Your record is cleaner and more pristine than my own record is, says the judge, and certainly cleaner and more pristine than the prosecutors are. Well, therein lies the story, because who is this prosecutor? His name is William M. Welch. He is the man, I think, most known in the country now for having handled the bungled prosecution of Alaska Senator Ted Stevens. In that case, remember, there were Brady Act violations.
By Brady Act, you mean they failed to disclose evidence to the defense.
Exactly. And it's also quite clear the prosecutors proceeded in that case to use evidence they knew was not true or was misleading. They brought all sorts of very strange charges. One thing that came out from the investigation, that they accused Senator Stevens of having accepted gifts of fairly nominal value, like a stuffed and lacquered salmon. And they accused him of corruption for having done that. And it turned out that the senior FBI agent putting together the prosecution had accepted gifts of the same value and the same nature. Yeah, so just a lot of just absolutely bizarre things. So, in fact, the prosecutor misled and made false statements to the court so consistently throughout the case that in the end, the judge handling that case, Judge Sullivan, just exploded, held him in contempt, and then appointed, judicially appointed prosecutor to investigate the prosecutors handling the case. And in fact, Welch tried to pin the blame for that on others who were working with him. One young prosecutor who was working with him committed suicide, telling his counsel that he felt his superiors were trying to pin the blame on him and not accepting their responsibility for what they had done wrong. But, you know, the Washingtonian also recently did a whole career profile of William Welch, and you see his entire career from the time he started as a federal prosecutor to the time he arrived at the Stevens case rested on a long chain of highly dubious prosecutions that were marked in almost every case by his abuse of power, pressure tactics, using doubtful evidence, failing to disclose to defense exculpatory evidence, and so forth. And Welch himself had a criminal record. In fact, he had been caught driving drunk outside of Springfield, Massachusetts.
So what happened?
Welch wanted to assess a $50,000 fine on Drake. At the end, he copped to a plea of misusing government equipment, a government computer, which is a crime of which no government employee is ever entirely innocent, but with which few are ever charged.
It's a misdemeanor, I think, right,
Scott? Exactly. It's a misdemeanor. It's sort of the equivalent of spitting on the sidewalk. A charge they could bring against anybody if they wanted to. They in this case, wanted to assess the maximum penalty with a big fine element, and they particularly wanted to fine him because he had received the Ridenour Prize, which is carries a $10,000 cash amount, for exactly the conduct that Welch had unsuccessfully tried to prosecute him, and the government said, we ought to be able to capture this back for the government. And the court said, that's absurd. No way. So no fine imposed. He was given a community service assignment, which, in fact, he requested. So I'd say, you know, absolutely minimal penalty. In fact, mostly just praise for him coming from the court.
Scott, they're going after whistleblowers, particularly in the, quote, what they consider the national security area. They're doing it much more under this administration than before. And I know you've written about other, and this is sort of a summary of where we are right now. You've written on other issues such as the state secrets privilege being invoked in various cases, including just recently in the case of allegation about an informant in mosques in Southern California. You've talked about it in the torture cases. Can you just give us some overall sense of what do you think is going on and why in the administration? I mean, this was an administration that came in that said it was going to not use state secrets broadly. It wasn't going to go after these whistleblowers in this way. And all of a sudden we're seeing, you know, really one of the greatest clampdowns that probably you and I can remember.
No, it's an amazing process, and I guess I've interviewed a number of people inside the Justice Department trying to find out, you know, what happened here. And I think what you can see what happened is that the Obama administration came in, it made certain campaign promises, and you see inside the Justice Department they have assigned people to change the policy guidelines. And they have. If you go back and you look at the policy guidelines that are out there for state secret invocation and the policy guidelines that are there for these whistleblower cases, they have been changed, and the guidelines are different from the Bush era, and they are on the face of the guideline more protective of whistleblowers and more reticent to use state secrets. But then the line officers who make the call about how to apply the guidelines make no change whatsoever. If anything, they're more aggressive than before. And you see no reach down from higher levels of the Justice Department to say, no, 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 this new policy means X. So there, I would say there is a weak, almost non-existent enforcement of the Obama policy changes, which means broadly continuity with the Bush administration. And in fact, even efforts to be more aggressive than the Bush administration was on some of these points. Inside the Justice Department, what I hear from lawyers there is the same complaint, and that is that the attitude they have now towards the CIA and the NSA is that these two agencies are their clients. They do the bidding of those agencies. They never question their characterizations or assessments. And I think that's what we see in the prosecution decisions here. So we see senior officials at the CIA and NSA who've been embarrassed by these disclosures, and they want to get even with the people who have embarrassed them. And the Justice Department is perfectly happy to just go out there and do their bidding. And if we go back 20 years, 30 years, there was a completely different attitude where the Justice Department was an independent arbiter of all these things and was very skeptical about some of these claims and simply wouldn't act on them. But that era is gone.
As usual, it's been fascinating to talk with you about yet another disturbing development under the Obama administration.
And we see sometimes that conservative Republican judges can be much better friends of civil liberties than the administration.
What does that say about where we are? Scott, best wishes for the rest of the summer, and we hope to talk to you in a month or two.
That would be my pleasure.
All right.
Thanks, Scott. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you or me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never die.
The emerging BDS movement is making waves at a food co-op in Brooklyn. It's not the first food co-op that's considering BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanction. A similar boycott, divestment, and sanction effort was successful in Olympia, Washington last year. The Olympia movement was supported by Nobel Prize winner Archbishop Desmond Tutu in the home city of Rachel Corrie. Today we're joined by National Lawyers Guild attorney Dennis James. Dennis has been active in anti-war civil rights and social justice issues. Dennis joins us today to discuss more about the BDS movement in Park Slope, Brooklyn, and its wider effort. We'll also be joined by attorney Barbara Harvey in Detroit, who has worked with BDS activists throughout the United States. Dennis James, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi.
Nice Dennis, in the interest of full disclosure here, you were my law partner in Detroit in the firm we had in the 60s, and you've since semi-retired and moved to Brooklyn, New York. You're active in the 16,000-member Park Slope Food Co-op in Brooklyn, and there's a real political fight going on there now with BDS out there, and I wanted to ask you about it. Can you tell me what the last meeting was like and where the struggle's at now?
Sure. And I admit to all of the above disclosures. I'm a co-op member, and the co-op has been around since the 70s. It's the oldest and largest food co-op in the United States.
It's got this is in Park Slope, Brooklyn.
It's in Park Slope on Union Street. It's got 16,000 members and a waiting list. Over the past 2 or 3 years, there has been a running dispute reflected in the letters to the editors of the Line Waiters Gazette, which is a little publication they have so that you can read while you're waiting in line, of counter charges and charges and regarding the issue of the handling of Israeli produced goods.
And that's BDS's boycott, divestment, sanction.
That's correct.
And when you say handling of Israeli goods,
that means the selling
of the selling of goods that are either produced in Israel or the settlements. The co-op looks at it as not just products from the settlement, but as products from Israel as well. Is that?
Yeah. It's that broad. And letters have sort of degenerated into a lot of name-calling. There has developed a movement to try to resolve this, to do it in a democratic way that's provided for by the procedures of the co-op, which was founded in a political sense. It's had a number of about 11 boycotts that have arisen at one time or another. They have procedures for how they determine whether or not there should be a boycott to something. I mean, they boycotted South African goods, Coca-Cola during labor disputes, grapes during those disputes, a number of times.
Is there currently a boycott now of Israeli goods, or is
no,
that what's going on? What's going on is the question of will there be and how will it be decided?
That's correct. The proposal made by the proponents of a boycott has been that it should be by a referendum of all 16,000 members rather than at a general membership meeting, which takes place once a month, in which maybe 300-400 people attend. It has a capacity of 500 people, the place where we meet, and might be decided just by who buses in largest number of people and packs the place. We think it would be better and more democratic to have the issue submitted by referendum where people can do their own research, vote in privacy, and not be intimidated by people yelling in the chair next to them, and do so thoughtfully. Have it decided that way, you know, once and for all.
So where are we now with it? Is it a very hot issue in the co-op?
Yes.
What's going to happen?
Okay, where we are now, slogging our way through the procedures of the co-op, right, is that there has been a meeting, which is specified in the process, of a pure discussion of the issue as to whether or not there should be a referendum on this, as opposed to deciding at a general membership meeting. That discussion meeting took place in this last general membership meeting. Now it's going to go to another general membership meeting on the issue of whether or not to have a referendum. I hope you follow.
Right, but isn't that, I want to get to here. I understand these general meetings are smaller, 300 to 500 people, uh-huh, and they're going to decide whether there should be a referendum among all the 16,000.
Yes.
But isn't it really the same issue? You seem to be saying, maybe mm-hmm, this is not right, is that if it goes to a general referendum, the chances of it of some kind of boycott emerging from that may be better than if it goes to the smaller 300 to 500 meeting, or at least that's what the opponents of BDS may want. They may want the smaller meeting because they can control that better. I'm trying to figure this out.
You're right. It's the same bottleneck,
right,
that we have to look at in terms of trying to get it through a referendum. And yet there are, we believe, a number of people who are like on the fence about the boycott itself and think that maybe it should go to a referendum. I don't know how I would vote, But after all, this is the best democratic approach to the thing, and I'll vote for the referendum, and who knows how I'll vote about the boycott. Depends on what educational materials I get on this, what I think about it myself, what my uncle tells me, etc. So, you know, we think we have a chance at getting it to go to a referendum.
Give us a sense of the types of products that would not be bought if there's a boycott.
There's not a big list of them. I mean, there's the Sabra line of hummus and other prepared foods that takes up a big counter there. There's Ahava products.
That's the Dead Sea salts that people use for makeup or whatever they do.
Right. And people are doing research as to what particular products there are. There's certain fresh foods that come in off season. I think basil has been one of them that come in off season that's been carried by the co-op.
Well, Dennis, it doesn't seem that it's just in terms of dollars and cents is going to make that much of a difference. But I guess it's the moral question that's so forceful, right?
Yeah, I think so. It'd be a very large symbolic factor if, you know, in Brooklyn, a 16,000-member food co-op votes to boycott Israeli goods.
What are the arguments for not boycotting? Our listeners and you, we all understand boycotting. You want to end the settlements, end Israel apartheid within the country, et cetera. What is someone saying? Why shouldn't they boycott?
Two principal objections come up. One is, why Israel? In other words, here's all this misery around the planet of the Chinese imposing on the Tibetans, the Turks imposing on the Kurds. Well, how come all this excitement about Israel? And the other one is, it will destroy the co-op. There's a big difference with respect to the example of Israel, and that is that we have the elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about, and that is U.S. support for everything Israel does, which is not characteristic of almost any other conflict, as bad as it might be, of majorities versus minorities throughout the world. I mean, we support this. We finance this. We back it up with a guaranteed veto in the UN whenever Israel wants it. We have our legislators in thrall to AIPAC. There's 81 of them in Israel right now on vacation.
Amazing.
Of a congressman paid for by AIPAC.
Unbelievable. As Chomsky said, partly because of the support, but partly because of the shape of the state of Israel.
Sure.
It's the U.S. aircraft carrier in the Middle East.
Yeah.
That's right. It doesn't look like an aircraft carrier.
They give Netanyahu 29 standing ovations. I mean, no president gets that. They're shaking in their boots as to whether or not AIPAC is going to come to their district and target them.
That seems like the right argument. It always has to me. But, you know, of course, you always get accused of saying, well, that I think what underlies it is obviously the support that people have for Israel, but they use it as a mask to say you're being anti-Semitic by focusing on Israel and not Turkey or Somalia or something.
Yeah.
But in fact, your argument is a very strong one. This is this is really the U.S. That's carrying this out and allowing it to occur.
And the second argument, Dan?
Yeah, the second argument that you're going to destroy the co-op. Well, I would just, first of all, there's 16,000 members and there's a waiting list. I mean, I don't think that's a danger. People really like the co-op and are gonna shop there because it's a great place to shop, even before this issue came up and will continue to be. But more importantly, I would call attention to who is saying this it's going to destroy the co-op. It's not any of the people who favor the boycott. In other words, the threat is people are going to walk out. It's not me. It's not people I know. It's not people I've heard of who support the boycott that are saying, well, if we lose on a referendum or at a general meeting, we're going to walk out. It's the other side, the anti-boycott people who are saying, we're going to walk out. In other words, we're going to destroy the co-op.
The very people who want to prevent the vote.
That's it. That's it. And that's typical of a lot of, unfortunately, the Zionist approach to issues that come up. They don't want to debate you. They want to destroy you. They want to shut you down to shut you up rather than continue a dialogue with you. So that's who you hear it will destroy it. Or it's said by people who know that that's who wants to leave if there is such a thing as a boycott. But I don't think there's really a danger of it.
Let me ask you, I want to put it in the context of what's happening in the U.S. This is one effort in the biggest co-op, earliest co-op at Park Slope. It's an important one, and I think it's symbolic of the changes we're seeing in the last few years. So, Dennis, let's for our last question, where do you expect this to end in Park Slope? And when? Give us a timeline.
Well, there's another 4 or 5 months before we have to turn in a formal application for what is to be voted on. It's worked out with the staff. Probably a couple of months of educational work after that by both sides. So I'm going to say if it happens within the year, I think we'll probably be doing pretty well.
So I know it's going to be a hard fight. I know what these internal fights are like. Thank you very much,
thank
Dennis.
You very
That's
much.
Great. And now to talk about the wider BDS movement, we're joined by Barbara Harvey, a National Lawyers Guild lawyer and member of the Free Palestine Committee.
National Lawyers Guild attorney from Detroit, Barbara Harvey, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Give us an idea of the global aspect of the BDS campaign.
Well, first of all, the name itself, the letters stand for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, a global movement that demands respect for universally recognized human rights and international law that Palestinian people are entitled to just as we are and just as Israelis are. It demands three things: an end to occupation, that is a return to the pre-67 Green Line, equal rights for Palestinian citizens of Israel, and recognition of the right of Palestinians who were driven from their homeland by the creation of the State of Israel to return.
When did the BDS movement globally start picking up steam?
Yeah, it started after the Second Intifada ended, but it really took off after a call that went out for a global BDS in 2005 from Palestinian civil society. 176 of the major Palestinian civil society organizations issued a joint call for global BDS. They asked for nonviolent economic resistance to occupation. It is incredibly significant as a united Palestinian call for nonviolent economic resistance to occupation in lieu of violence, and needs to be honored as such. In fact, when the Knesset, as it just passed a bill to outlaw BDS, it is outlawing peaceful economic resistance and leaving only one option, which is violence.
When all the support for BDS was forthcoming after the Second Intifada, did it have much of an effect on Israel?
It has an effect so far that is psychological, and that effect has been huge, in fact, because if it weren't huge, Israel would not be taking the universally condemned extraordinary step of this anti-BDS law, which has been condemned by all around the world, including even in the pages of the New York Times, and the U.S. major Zionist organizations, AIPAC, the Jewish Federation, the JCRC, and other Zionist organizations in this country would not have jointly created a $6 million fund dedicated to defeating the BDS movement in the United States.
You know, it's remarkable. I mean, I agree with you. I think the psychological impact, the political impact, the Israelis at least perceive it as huge, I guess because they think of themselves as sort of the golden knights or something in the world, and that they're perfect and that you can't touch them because of course, their history, et cetera. So I agree with you. I think it's big. But, you know, you've talked about there's the Israeli law now that's going after NGOs and others who would talk about or really do anything almost with BDS. But there's some proposals in the United States, I think it's called the Berman Amendment, in which they're trying to do. Is it a similar thing in the United States?
Yeah, well, it's something that we should not allow ourselves to be distracted by, in my opinion. It is an effort to revive, that is to reenact, anti-boycott provisions of an old Export Administration Act. These anti-boycott provisions expired a decade ago, but they were continued by presidential emergency orders, including one signed by President Obama. These provisions are not addressed to BDS activity. They are intended to prohibit cooperation by U.S. people, in that includes corporations, with the Arab League boycott against Israel. It's intended to prevent exporters from cooperating with and supporting the Arab League boycott. It is not directed against human rights campaigns, such as BDS is.
So Berman is along that line. So
Berman is exactly, pretty much exact reenactment of these older anti-boycott provisions, which have continued as regulations. The difference would be that instead of being regulations, they would once again be reenacted as law. And he also makes the penalties harsher.
We understand the Israeli law, the U.S. law, which hopefully, at least in the U.S., it doesn't seem to really have any effect on the BDS movement here. But can you bring us up to date on where you see the BDS movement in the United States right now? We spoke to someone about the Park Slope efforts at BDS. I know there was one in Olympia, Washington. Two of the smaller efforts, if you can talk about Olympia at all or any of the other efforts that are going on that you're involved in.
Yes. Let me just, though, quickly add before responding to your question that the Berman bill is not law. Probably will not be law because the Senate, it was an amendment to the House State Department funding bill, and it does not appear in the Senate equivalent and probably will not make it. So at this point, it is premature to start talking about the Berman law. But to answer your question, the Olympia Food Co-op is actually an important story. It refers to the Olympia Co-op in the state of Washington, and Olympia was the hometown of Rachel Corrie, who was the young Evergreen College student who was bulldozed to her death by the Caterpillar D9 weaponized bulldozer that she was standing in front of for the purpose of protecting a house in Gaza from being destroyed. So that community had some greater degree of education about the brutality of the occupation than the rest of the United States, and it's no surprise that it went first. It adopted a boycott against the purchase for resale of all goods from Israel in accordance with the goals of the BDS movement a year ago. It has been successful in that project. It has been under the gun ever since it did it from some of its members who are angry about the decision and from others. But the fact is that it hasn't hurt business, it hasn't backed off, and it hasn't hurt business. And this sort of highlights something that all the hysteria fomented by the opponents of BDS would like us to lose sight of, which is that the majority of American Jews in this country really genuinely want a fair and peaceful resolution of the conflict that will bring stability and end the trauma for American Jews. And the whole Netanyahu administration has been a real trauma for American Jews because it has been a rather naked attack against dissent in Israel, which is an embarrassment to American Jews.
Barbara, I know you're also involved in some of the campaigns yourself. I think you were involved in the TIA-CREF campaign with Jewish Voice for Peace. Is that right?
That's right. And that is significant as the first Jewish-conceived national campaign, divestment campaign. TIA-CREF is a retirement behemoth. It has more than $400 billion in assets that it administers. And it is highly regarded globally and prides itself as being a socially conscious investment fund because it caters, I assume, because it caters to teachers and professors and other leaders of nonprofit organizations. So it caters to the most educated and thoughtful portions of our population. Yet, in its socially responsible investment portfolio are such amazing investments as Caterpillar and Motorola, which supplies the walkie-talkies that the IDF forces use to maintain the occupation.
And the Caterpillars supply the bulldozers to run over Arab schools and homes.
That's correct.
So how is that campaign going on TIA-CREF?
Well, it is going very well in some respects, and it has also a long way to go. It is going very well in the sense that it has really been, it has gotten off to a great start as an educational tool to begin to raise consciousness here in this country about the occupation and why it is morally indefensible.
And you're making some progress?
Well, we're making progress in the sense that the organization is painfully aware of our campaign to the point that it fled New York City, which is where it routinely holds its annual meetings, and went to
Salt Lake City,
North Carolina.
Salt Lake City. So, Barbara, I want you to give some information about where people can go, both for the TIA CREF boycott, as well as other websites they might look to. If they want to learn more about BDS, boycott, and what they can do?
Great question. They can, for the TIAA CREF campaign, they can go to wedivest.org. Wedivest, one word, .org. There is a wonderful website called whoprofits.org, which identifies all of the companies that profit from the occupation and how they profit and where they are located and where you can find them and what their products are. The BDS movement itself maintains an incredibly large website. It's called bdsmovement.net, and it's maintained by the BNC, which is the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions National Committee by Palestinians. There's another website called El Shebaka, which is spelled al-shabaka.org, which is a scholarly project open to the public online of articles and discussions on how to bring an end to occupation in a way that honors the three goals that I've identified earlier of the BDS movement. Those are some of the really fine websites.
We've been speaking with Barbara Harvey, who is a National Lawyers Guild lawyer, international committee member, and doing a lot of work on BDS, and particularly as a member of the Free Palestine Committee of the National Lawyers Guild. Barbara, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.